obviously insane in a perfect situation. I let love down the drain. There's the pitch, slow and straight. All I have to do is swing and I'm a hero. But I'm zero.
Hi, welcome to another edition of the 19th Hole Golf Show. I'm Ryan Ballingy. Good to have you here with us. You can get a hold of me on Twitter at Ryan Ballingy, or you can get a hold of Golf News Net on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Snapchat at the handle Golf News Net. You can download the GNN app, now available in Google Play and the Apple App Store. And you can find our work on golfnewsnet.com as well. Much of our work on Yahoo Sports' Devil Ball Golf blog on sports.yahoo.com. We're presented by betdsi.com. We use their odds every single week in our PGA Tour and European Tour odds posts. They're great for fantasy golfers and punters alike because you get to see what action is actually out there, how the percentages play out for each player in the field, especially on your winning bets. And they give you a good idea of how the money's moving. And it's a great point of comparison as you try to make your rankings and picks every single week for fantasy golf, whether you bet or not. So check out betdsi.com. This week's show, we have really two segments. I mean, they could be basically two podcasts, you know, one on each unto itself. But one to kind of put together into a long-form podcast. And it'll probably be about 40 minutes when we all get done talking and listening here. But the key things I wanted to talk about are obviously a reaction to what happened to Dustin Johnson at Oakmont and the finish for the U.S. Open. And then secondarily, the reaction to Rory McIlroy choosing not to play in the Olympics for Ireland and the potential subsequent fallout of that. Probably spend more time really on Dustin and the implications of what the USGA chose to do for the future of rules, for the future of the sport and all that jazz, and then probably about 15 minutes or so on Rory. You know, I've had a lot, and I also wanted to apologize really briefly, because I said after we talked with David Abeles about the future of TaylorMade Golf, hey, we're going to have another podcast later on the week with Bob Friend, we'll talk about the golf course, blah, blah, blah. Obviously, that never came to fruition, and that's in part on me, that's in part also on the rain from Wednesday and Thursday, basically ruining our schedule of doing podcasts and throwing us into 16-hour days just to cover the golf tournament. So I want to apologize for that. I had a great time talking to Bob. We're actually going to put up a piece this evening, I think, on golfnewsnet.com about playing Oakmont the Monday after the Open. It'll give you a little bit of a sense of what it was like to play Oakmont, even though it wasn't entirely under U.S. Open conditions, and it certainly wasn't under U.S. Open pressure. But I wanted to relay that to you, give you a little bit of something to talk about, at least about the golf course, even if it is several days after the championship ended. So let's talk about Dustin Johnson. Let's talk about the USGA and what happened on the fifth green. So let's start with the fifth green. Obviously, you've all seen the video by now, so by way of recap, here's what happened. Dustin Johnson missed about a 4 or 5 foot birdie putt on the fifth hole from above the hole. It went past the hole 6 to 7 feet by, and Dustin Johnson is getting ready to hit that par putt. And he takes a couple of practice strokes, very close to the ball, admittedly, but very close to the ball. And then he gets ready to put the putter blade back behind the ball and address the putt. But before he puts it down, puts the sole of the putter down, the ball moves slightly. Johnson recoils, pulls the putter back, calls the rules official over, who's walking with the group, explains what has happened. The rules official likely saw it the whole way, but wants to hear Dustin's accounting of it. He says, I don't think I made the ball move under Rule 18-2. Not that Dustin Johnson knew Rule 18-2, nor do I really expect him to, but that rule changed in 2016 to say that there's no 18-2B and that the player is not presumed to have made the ball move, and instead they don't necessarily have to move the ball from addressing it or not addressing it, but that if they've caused the ball to move, then they are assessed a one-stroke penalty. And under that rule, with the walking official and Johnson's story, Lee Westwood corroborated, was obviously right there, playing partner for the day. The official decided that this is okay, everything is fine, there is no penalty, and we move on. So, from there, 7 holes later, on the 12th tee, a USGA official, or two, walks up to Dustin Johnson, and they tell him they may penalize him for what happened on the fifth green, but that that penalty would not be ruled one way or the other, assessed or not, until Johnson finished his round and could review the video footage with a four-member committee that determines these penalties. So, Johnson has to play the final seven holes of the round, not knowing one way or the other if a one-stroke penalty was going to be assessed. So, I don't know if he actually thought this. He said he just kind of tried to keep going. But it's somewhere along the way, I'm sure he probably thought, I've got to win by two. As someone explained to me, ping pong rules. I think it was Jay Hart from Yahoo explained to me. Ping pong rules or volleyball rules. You know, you got to win by two and it's got to be on your own serve. And so he plays the rest of the way out and he pars 12. It's a monster drive on 12. Pars out there, has one bogey coming in through 17. And meanwhile, you've got Shane Lowry in the group behind. He was the 54-hole leader, you'll remember. So he bogeys three in a row. Sergio Garcia bogeys two in a row with an incredibly gnarly lie in a bunker on the second bogey. Westwood was already out of it. You had Scott Piercy just kind of hanging around, but he was ahead of Johnson, bogeyed 16 and 18. So by the time Dustin Johnson gets to the 18th tee, whether he knew it or not, and it sounds like he didn't entirely know, he had a three-shot advantage, and all he needed was a par to win. And if he, even if he bogeyed the hole, the edge would be two. No matter what happens with the penalty, he wins. Hits an incredible drive right down the middle of the fairway in a position in 18 where he could have laid back a little bit more if he wanted and played the super safety pick, then hit five iron in. But he chose to take on the position between the two fairway bunkers, you know, on the left and the right side. And he took it on beautifully, found the dead center of the fairway. And then, from about 190 to 200 yards, hits a 6-iron to 6 feet. It was the coolest scene, I think, ever in a major championship that I've been to personally. And I'll say that because of the unification of the crowd and the guy that was there. Everyone on that hole had a sense of what was going to happen from Dustin Johnson. And they had a sense of what the USGA was about to do or thinking of doing or might have done or didn't do to Dustin. And they all, to a person, were against the USGA. No one was against Dustin. Dustin Johnson became a sympathetic figure. And I know he has been somewhat of one before because of his hard luck in the majors. But because of his personal troubles in the past, because he walked away from the sport, you know, but to deal with personal issues and whatever those were, he will not detail. But people wanted Dustin Johnson to finish this out because what the USGA had done to him and what they had hung over his head for seven holes. And for him to hit it to 6 feet, the crowd erupted with a huge ovation, started chanting, DJ, DJ. I mean, I've never heard someone get their name chanted at them at a golf tournament other than the Ryder Cup. President's Cup, you know, a team competition where it's a little bit different atmosphere, but not in an individual competition. And for him to finish that out with a birdie, I mean, that was the double middle finger to the USGA. Like, there is no way you're going to stop me now. You can't stop me. And the crowd got all excited. Paulina runs out very briefly. I mean, she didn't realize the etiquette that, hey, Shane Lowry still had to go through. Lee Westwood was a man when he was on the back of the green, took his hat off to Johnson, and I don't know what he said to the guy. I'm pretty sure it's not something you could repeat on television. It gave him a handshake, a real handshake, not some limp fish bullshit, but a real man's handshake. Congratulations, thanks for taking it to whatever they had to say to each other. Dustin Johnson bailed out the USGA. The USGA shouldn't have been that lucky. They should have had to go to a playoff, or Shane Lowry should have won by a shot or something like that. So the USGA should have felt the full wrath of what they had done here. And during the middle of the telecast, Fox brings in Jeff Hall from the USGA, and he's trying to explain in blubbering, fumbling terms what the rule is, what Rule 18-2 is, and why there might be evidence that Johnson gets a penalty. And he's insinuating the entire time. I'm sure you watch this on the telecast. They're going to penalize Johnson. There was no, well, we might not. They were basically out and out saying, we're going to penalize him. Unless he basically proves that our video evidence, whatever the hell that was, different than what they're showing on television, exonerates him. I have a big problem with that. And I also have a big problem with the explanation that the USGA chose to give on Golf Channel after the fact. And I have to give a lot of credit to Brandel Chamblee. I know he is a divisive figure. You either love Brandel Chamblee because he tells it like it is, which he doesn't always, or you hate the guy because he thinks he tells it like it is. It's somewhere in between. But the guy believes something. He goes after it. And you have to have conviction sometimes. And he had a lot of conviction that Dustin Johnson did nothing wrong and should never have been penalized. And he prosecuted those two guys, Thomas Pagel and Jeff Hall. And he did it for a good 12 minutes. And they had nothing for him. Nothing definitive for him. No video evidence that made it certain that it was more likely than not that it was Dustin Johnson's fault that he caused the ball to move. He asked them question after question to try to get them to prove their point, and they couldn't do it. Kudos to Brandel Chamblee for making those guys look like they didn't know what they were talking about. And I know that they do. They know the rules of golf. They write the damn things. They changed Rule 18-2 for 2016. They knew what the change was, and that's about as far as they took it. But they also came out on Monday and said, hey, you know, we made a boo-boo. We shouldn't have held this over Dustin Johnson's head for 7 holes. But we think we got the ruling right in the end, so hooray for us. And I cannot support that. Because, for one, the ruling was wrong. The ruling was flat-out wrong. It's basic physics. And if you would like to be a physics major, or if Bryson DeChambeau listens, feel free to let me know that this isn't basic physics. But because Dustin Johnson took practice strokes next to the ball, not behind the ball, not the other side of the ball, not in front of the ball. He took those practice strokes to the side of the ball. If he made an indentation into the putting surface, which, by the way, playing Oakmont, I made 3 in 18 holes. 3 in 18 holes. And not with my putter, but with full force of my iron shots or the driver that I hit into number 8. But those are the 3 that I made during the round. So if he made even the slightest indentation in the green, let's say he did, shouldn't the ball have moved toward him, not away from him? And it took a full second for those after those practice strokes for the ball to have moved. Now, again, I am not a physicist, but I know how friction works. And I know friction doesn't have a delay. It can mount up over time, but not that slowly. It doesn't take that long, especially on greens running 15 on the stimp and that firmness for the ball to move. If the ball was going to move, it was going to move. So I think the physics are wrong here. And then you have a couple of other issues with the rules. The first starts with the very end of the rule book, which is Rule 34-2 under referee's decision. Quote, if a referee has been appointed by the committee, and you don't need to know what that bullshit is, his decision is final. So what's the point of having a referee whose decision is supposedly final if it's not? We need to create a statute of limitations around how long you can dispute a ruling. If you don't want 34-2 to mean anything, fine, change the rule. But if you need to change the rule, then we need to create that statute of limitations. And this comes from someone who has had someone else disqualified in the past inadvertently by reporting a rule violation that happened on video that no one called and no one else seemed to see. I'm partially responsible for Camila Vijayga's getting that disqualification several years ago in Hawaii. Friend of mine, Dave Andrews, shot me a note in the middle of the night, basically, because I was asleep on my couch, and asked me to review what Camilo had done on a hole where he had moved a divot away as the ball was rolling back to him. He was trying to do the right thing, Vijayga's was. He was trying to let it roll out as much as it was going to roll out. But by moving that divot, he violated a rule, and he didn't call a penalty on himself. And I emailed the PGA Tour official out there at the time. I believe it was John Bush. And I told John, hey, I hope Camilo hasn't signed for his card yet. I think he's violated a rule. Here's what happened. He had signed for his card. He was disqualified. So someone who has been a part of a video disqualification, I still believe in the power of video. And I still believe in using video to get things right. Other sports do that. But other sports also have a statute of limitations. Whether it's a couple of minutes, whether they stop play entirely, which pretty much every sport does, stops play entirely to look at a play. Basketball, they don't always do that in the first half. They might not. But they stop play entirely, and they look at it, and nothing else happens until that's decided. And I think that that needs to apply here in golf in some fashion. You can't stop a field of players, be it a weekend field, a full field of 156, 144, 120, whatever it is. You can't stop them from playing golf. But what you can do is create a statute of limitations to say that after the hole on which a potential penalty may have occurred, then there is a one-hole window for someone to either raise their hand via video or elsewhere and call the penalty out, or for the referee to review the decision with the committee, or whatever terminology you want to use, higher up, rules committee, whatever that is. Once that's done, it's over. That's it. If you didn't catch it then you're not going to catch it later. And I know that they've tried to come up with Rule 33-7, which is kind of an absolution of if you get bad advice, more or less it's not your fault. Or if you don't take a penalty that you should have taken, then you don't necessarily have to get disqualified. You might just be asked to take the penalty because you got bad information. All of those things, it's fine. But we need a statute of limitations here. Then the other piece of this is obviously Rule 18, 18-2, which, as I mentioned, was changed. So the part of this, and this is the important part here, I think, the equipment of the player or his partner causes the ball to move. The player incurs a penalty of one stroke. That is the rule itself. That's part two of that. And under the rules, there's no penalty if a player accidentally causes his ball to move following a series of circumstances. Repairing a hole plug or ball mark, measuring, lifting a ball, replacing a ball, removing a loose impediment on the green, by removing movable obstructions. However, except as permitted by the rules, when a player's ball is in play, if the player, his partner, or one of his caddies either lifts or moves the ball, touches it purposely, except with a club, in the act of addressing the ball, or causes the ball to move. So, under this rule, under this interpretation of the rule, the USGA said the preponderance of the evidence only has to suggest Dustin Johnson made the ball move. That's a dangerous standard. That's 50.1%. That's what it is, a preponderance of the evidence in a civil trial. So you're saying that if Dustin had a 50.1% chance of making that move, he should serve the full stroke penalty, not a half stroke penalty, not a preponderance of the penalty. No, you get the full stroke. I don't know that you can establish that precedent. It's a dangerous one. And I say that because we also had two other instances over the weekend between Shane Lowry and Romain Wattel of a ball moving while they were on the green. Lowry got a penalty. I believe Wattel did not. And how they determined whether or not each of those three players caused the ball to move is inconsistent at best. So if you're going to do this, you need to create a universal standard. It needs to be not anywhere between 50.1 and 100% sure that they caused the ball to move. It needs to be 100% sure that the player caused the ball to move. And I say that because it's almost impossible to prove to the affirmative. Because if Dustin Johnson made the ball move by taking practice strokes near the ball, according to the USGA, then why didn't that happen when all the other players in the field did that on varying greens that were 15 on the stimp and as hard as a rock? That doesn't make any sense. That should happen a whole lot more often. And if you establish that's possible and that's the precedent, then how far away does a player have to stand from the ball and make practice strokes to to absolve themselves of the possibility of either depressing the ground, creating wind, or creating some kind of mini earthquake tremor that forces the ball to move. I don't know what that standard would be, and I'm not sure the USGA knows. In fact, I know they don't know because they didn't think about it that far. And so they have a problem with this rule. The rule needs to be changed. 18-2 should be changed pretty much entirely to restrict to the point is the only way you get the penalty is if you touch it purposely. That's it. If you touch it purposely, if you move it purposely, if you use your putter blade, if you kick it, if you try to whiff it a little bit closer to the hole, all of those things, that is the only way you should incur a penalty under rule 18-2. That's it. Change it for the next iteration of the rules. Make that change immediately, as soon as you can. I know the rules are in cycles, they're 4-year cycles, but this needs to be done immediately. I don't care. So there's that. And then there's the problem of trying to reconcile that golf is a sport of integrity with what the USGA basically has called Dustin Johnson, Lee Westwood, and the walking official. And they didn't out and out call them liars because they didn't say those words. But the implication in overruling the walking official's ruling, as well not taking Dustin Johnson and Lee Westwood at their word, you're calling them liars, or at a minimum, you are calling their integrity into question. So you have crowned a U.S. Open champion that you think is a liar, or a cheater, or both, or an idiot because he doesn't know the rule. But no one knew the rule because the rule isn't clear. It doesn't say 50.1% in the rule book. It says causes the ball to move. Well, it doesn't say 100% certain causes the ball to move. And I'm sure Dustin Johnson did not know this text. Since I'm reading it to you, I am most certain he has never read this. He's probably been in a rules meeting like, who cares? Because rules are boring. The rules of golf are really boring. They're not very interesting. But if you're going to go on national TV, international TV, and say and then issue a statement the day after, we made the right ruling in assessing that one-stroke penalty. No, you didn't. And I don't care if you've got your 50.1%, that's dubious at best. I don't care if you overrule your own rule about the referee's decision. You got it wrong because you marred a championship moment for Dustin Johnson where he made a 6-foot putt to just stuff it in your face. And he said, oh yeah, well, you've won by 4. Now you've won by 3. That 68 you shot, that's a 69 now. And forever in memory, you'll be 4 under par, when really, Dustin Johnson shot 275. I don't give a crap what that goes down as on the official leaderboard in the annals of USGA history. Dustin Johnson was by far the best player, and to take that even a little bit away from him by insinuating that he either didn't know the rules, was cheating, or was a liar, that's low. And then to come back out the next day and say, well, we did it right. We just shouldn't have told him on the 12th tee. We should have just done it. Or we should have told him after. That's hubris. And I'm extremely disappointed in Mike Davis to have not come out, other than on Golf Channel, to say, we would like a mulligan. Which, if you're pedantic, you have made a sarcastic joke that there is no such thing as a mulligan in golf, and the rulemaking body wants a mulligan. I got it. Har har. But for Mike Davis to practically be invisible, force Jeff Hall and Thomas Pagel out there as the CEO, he is the CEO of the USGA, and to not be more visible shows a lack of leadership. I know that he is the setup guy for the US Open, and I know he takes great pride in that, and he works really hard at it. And he did a great job setting up this golf course, despite 3 inches of rain over 2 days that threw this tournament into chaos. This was a tremendous setup. None of the players complained, at least about the setup. They might not have liked how the championship was conducted, but they at least liked the setup. And for him to not step out of that role and be the CEO and say, I need to be the face of this organization, because Diana Murphy sure as heck wasn't going to be it. She's the president, and I won't talk about all of that, but you saw the trophy presentation ceremony, and that was not very good. I don't know why that wasn't very good, but that was not very good. So Mike Davis needs to be the permanent face of this organization as CEO. Come out and do more than just say we made a mulligan on Golf Channel. You need to go on Fox. You need to go on Good Morning America. You need to talk to Today Show and do all of these things where you explain what happened in clearer terms, either admonish your people for their mistake or explain it better than what we got. And then we can maybe move on. And instead, we're in a position now where for about another year, the USGA is going to be the bad guy. And I don't think that's good for golf. And I don't think that what happened makes people want to pick up a golf club and compete because they're like, well, these rules suck. And if they're going to go like this, I'm not going to play this game. That doesn't make any sense. But for golfers, a lot of golfers just roll their eyes at the rules. They have no regard for them whatsoever, or at least not a lot of regard for them whatsoever. So they're not worried about it. But getting other people attracted to this game, that was the opposite of what happened on Sunday. I mean, I hope people were really impressed by what Dustin Johnson did because it was amazing to watch. But the rules aspect of it had to be a huge rally kill for a lot of people. And I'm sad about that. I wish that wasn't the case. I wish that weren't the case. And so I need Mike Davis to come out and say more than what he said. So all of these things come together, and I don't know what the result is going to be for Aaron Hills next year. I'm sure the same number of people are going to try and qualify for the U.S. Open. It'll be 9,000 people. It'll be like the third or fourth greatest ever, blah, blah. But there's going to be an air over this championship next year of still trying to resolve what happened this year because there was no resolution other than Dustin Johnson winning to this problem, and it needs to be resolved quickly. Aaron Hills next year could either be brilliant. I really like the golf course. I played it last summer at the PGA Championship week. Or it could be an absolute disaster at 8,000 and change from the tips. And they say they won't play it at 8,000. I'm sure they'll play it at 79.99 to prove a point. You have a 700-yard finishing hole. You're going to have a lot of holes with undulations where if they get it as firm and as fast as they like, the ball could move backwards in the fairways, not just the greens. The fairways, we could have this problem again, and it could have a big impact on the championship since we've now established the precedent that if in someone's eyes it's a 50.1% chance that something's happened, it happened. I would rather have the criminal standard than the civil standard if we're going to prosecute these things this way. But it shouldn't be that. It should be 100% or nothing. And I'm going to harp on this for a while. I'm not going to forget this. I don't think a lot of people are going to forget this. And I think it makes the argument for a lot of PGA Tour players, including I Told You So guy, Charlie Hoffman, who think that this championship is run by a bunch of amateurs because the USGA runs a lot of amateur championships. He's right. They're not professionals. They don't do this week to week. It's not their job. There's a lot of volunteers that don't run championships from day to day of this caliber. And I don't think that the USGA wants to get into that kind of reputation. Maybe they've already got it, but I hope that that's not the case, and I hope that we can all collectively learn from this, that we can improve the rules of golf because of this, that the anger can be channeled into progress. But so far, 4 days after this happened, I don't feel like we're on the progress train. Maybe that'll change, so stay tuned. All right, final 10 minutes of the show or so, we'll talk about Rory McIlroy deciding not to play in the Olympics because of Zika. There's not a large response here. There's not a lot of minutiae to this. The reality is, Rory McIlroy is engaged to Erica Stoll. They're going to get married soon. Whenever that is, we don't know. It doesn't matter. They want to have kids. Probably pretty soon. Sooner than later. Probably before McIlroy is 30. He's got a little time. But sooner than later. And if they're going to do that, they need to have the assurance that McIlroy does not carry Zika, doesn't get Zika, doesn't carry Zika, doesn't transmit it to Erica when she's pregnant or anything like that. And we don't have enough science, as far as I can tell, that can guarantee how long Zika could remain in a man's body, particularly in a sperm that could cause birth defects if connected to one of Erica's eggs. It's that simple. Okay, I got it. So that makes sense to me, and I think that this was a tough decision for McIlroy because he came out earlier in the year at the Wells Fargo Championship and said all of these guys deciding not to play could be bad for golf's future in the Olympics. Then the Irish Open, after he wins, he says, well, I'm not so sure I'm going to play because I have concerns about Zika virus. Then a couple weeks later, he shows back up at the Memorial and says, I am going to play. I've done my research, which was probably WebMD.com, and I've decided I'm going to play. I'm assuaged of my fears. And then, what, 3 weeks later or 2 weeks later, he is not. He is not playing in the Olympics. And he has decided, based on his family's counsel, and probably in part because of what Erica may have felt about this issue, he ain't going, and he ain't playing for Ireland, and that's that. So the guy that's supposed to back him up or was going to be guy number two, would have been Shane Lowry's guy number one technically, but this, be guy number two would be Graham McDowell. And he says, thanks, but no thanks. I'm not playing because my wife Kristen is pregnant, due in September, with the Olympics in August. I don't want to be out of this country while she's getting ready to give birth. Nothing to do with Zika. Just don't want to be around, out of the country, doing anything, much less playing in the Olympics in a corrupt government country run by a corrupt government and bordering on a depression with a lot of crime, a lot of disease, nasty water with a lot of poop in it, and, oh yeah, that Zika. So I completely understand that too. And Jason Day hinted yesterday, PGA Championship Media Day, I'm thinking about having more kids with Ellie. We're not done with Dash and Lucy, so shrug. And that should tell you all you need to know. I don't think he's going to play in the Olympics either, because he's come to the conclusion that he's not done raising his family and he doesn't need Zika virus to stop that anytime soon. So kiss that goodbye. Now you've got Jordan Spieth, who started to back off his commitment to playing in the Olympics. He said this is the U.S. Open. Someone said, basically asked him, so what made you 100% commit to the Olympics? He said, hey, you're putting words in my mouth. So, hey, I'm not trying to do that, Haas. But if that's what he's saying, then that means he's not committed. Ricky Fowler's not committed. He's still looking at it with his team. Danny Willett's concerned about it. We have a lot of guys who don't want to be a part of this. Now, I find this remarkable that there has been no major female player to date that has said the same thing that these guys have said. And someone passed along to me that whatever science, whatever emerging science or knowledge about Zika suggests that it's more known how long Zika can live in women. It's unknown how long it can remain dormant in men, particularly in their sperm. So that leads a lot of guys to wonder if they, even if they get it, they might not know it. And if they don't know it, then they don't want to be the source of what could amount to a birth defect for their children. I got it. I completely understand that thought process. Completely and totally understand it. So I guess my feeling about McIlroy's decision is, you do you. And I think that I feel that way in part because the guys feel the same way, probably. And that is, we haven't been in the Olympics in 112 years. Not being in it 116 years doesn't make that much of a difference to us. Golf will be in the Olympics in 2020. Its future will be voted on in 2017, so it may only be in one more time. But all of these guys are going to be around in 2020. They're going to change the criteria probably because stroke play with 60 players is stupid. But even if they change it, there's a good chance all of these guys are going to get back in. And if they all get back in, then they get to go to Tokyo on a golf course that's already built in an environment that's pretty good and in a country that, while not necessarily expanding all that much economically, and they have deflation and all that crap, at least it's stable, and they can go there and compete. And if that's the only time golf is in the Olympics, well, just so happened to work for them. So I think that's the thought process. And I have no problem with any of that. I think Olympic golf can be a good thing, but I think they erred in so many ways in creating this concept that it's kind of come home to roost. But this isn't a karma discussion. This is a reality discussion. And I think golfers in particular have no attachment to the Olympics because this is like a new thing for them. It's like, hey, here's a new candy bar. Would you like to try it? Okay, yeah, I'll try it out. And then you take a bite of it. You're like, oh, that's new. I mean, that's a free candy bar. but it's a bad candy bar. I do not want that candy bar. And that's pretty much what happened with the Olympics, because there is no commitment here. It's not like there could be any pressure applied from the totally made-up International Golf Federation. It's basically just the PGA Tour and a bunch of other governing bodies coming together like, hey, we need something. We need an office in Rio. Let's form the IGF. All right, I got it. So there's nothing to stop these guys. At least on the women's side, there seems to be more of a sense of unity about this, about the potential value for growing women's golf. And there seems to be a sense of duty to that. Not to the Olympics, but to growing women's golf. And I think that is a positive thing, but I also think in the end, there are going to be female players who come along and go, I just don't think this is for me. I want to have a family, or want to expand my family, whatever the rationale, whatever the reason is. It's not scheduling. And I know a number of these guys that have bailed out have referenced scheduling in their bailout decision. And so they're kind of like, hey, I got to play a lot of golf. I got to play two majors in 3 weeks. I've got the Open Champ. I've got the Firestone if I'm going to play that. Then a few weeks, then all of a sudden we're at the British Open. Then we got a week, which is the Canadian Open, and then we've got the PGA Championship. We got a week, then we have 4 FedEx Cup events in 5 weeks. Then if you're an American or European, you probably have the Ryder Cup. And all of a sudden, throwing the Olympics in there doesn't seem like the best idea. And it's an opportunity to take time off. I think if golf had gone really all in, and we've done a podcast on this before, and it's called How Golf Screwed Up the Olympics, if you want to listen to it on your podcasting service of choice, the main primary issue is that golf, especially on the men's side, did not clear its calendar for the Olympics. They just shoehorned it in. And because they shoehorned it in, a lot of guys didn't want to be a part of an even busier schedule that at this time of year for the sport is always zany. And so John Deere Classics have a pretty good field because it is the opposite field event against the Olympics. But for the guys that don't want to play, it's an opportunity to rest. They don't need to go down to Brazil and spend a week and worry about getting robbed and Zika and inhaling poop water and all this stuff. They don't need to do that. They could just stay at home. So this is kind of their built-in break for the FedEx Cup playoffs. Smart. Why not do that? I'm not going to say anything negative about Rory McIlroy's decision. I think, again, if it is your choice and it fits with your lifestyle that this does not fit, then you get out of there and you do you. Good for you. Let's move on. And let's see who shows up. And if we get a good field, if we don't have a mass exodus that this might precipitate, then that's a good thing. And we could still have a very nice tournament despite the Zika fears and be able to continue the sport's evolution in the Olympics, which I would like to see. I would like to see golf in the Olympics beyond 2020. I'd like to see it with a completely different format. I'd like to see it with amateurs. I'd like to see it with a team component. We can make those changes. But with golf being an outdoor sport that has no attachment to these games, I completely understand why people are reluctant to play. That's going to do it for us this week on the show. Next week, we will talk a little bit about the Quicken Loans National. We'll catch up on what's happening in the world of golf. I'm sure something crazy will happen since it always seems to this time of year. Give us a 5-star review if you take a listen to us on iTunes. We really appreciate it. You don't have to write the review. If you want, you can, and we would love the feedback. You can submit a question through that as well. We'll be happy to answer it in the air. But if you do listen to us on iTunes, we'd love a 5-star review. Or you can do one better and download the GNN app for your Apple or Android device. And you can listen to all of our podcasts that way, as well as several others, including A Good Talk Spoiled, Talk Birdie to Me, Locked On Golf, and more coming by the week. So we'll have basically all of your golf podcasting needs covered in the GNN app, as well as all of our news and videos available, again, in the Google Play Store and the Apple App Store. So until next week, I'm Ryan Balaji saying thanks so much for being a part of our show, and we'll catch you next time on the 19th hole.